Hello and welcome to the Crisis Point Podcast. I'm Eric Sammons, your host and the editor-in-chief of Crisis Magazine. Before we get started with today's podcast, just want to remind people to like and subscribe to the channel wherever you listen to it, wherever you watch it. I really appreciate that and let other people know about it. Also, I just want to bring up, I appreciate people consider donating to Crisis Magazine, www.crisismagazine.com/donate. We accept all types of payment, including even cryptocurrency. So however you want to donate to us, we do appreciate it. It helps us keep doing what we're doing. So today I have a great guest. I have a very special guest, Dr. Anthony Esselin. He is a contributing editor to Crisis, but that's probably the least amount of what he is. He's a professor and writer in residence at Magdalen College of Liberal Arts. He's the author of many books, of which we'll probably bring up a few today. One of my favorites is 10 Ways to Destroy the Imagination of Your Child. That was written a number of years ago, but I really enjoy that one. His most recent, I think, is In the Beginning Was the Word, an annotated reading of the prologue of John, which I am currently reading. Hope to maybe have a review of that at some point at Crisis. I also have to mention that he is my wife's favorite author, which my kids think is funny since I'm also an author, but she makes it very clear she's always loved Dr. Esselin's work. So welcome to the program.
Thanks, Eric. It's great to be here.
So what we want to talk about today is the idea of culture, restoring culture, restoring specifically Catholic culture. I know America is not a Catholic country, but we do have some Catholic cultural artifacts, I think, within us. And we want to talk about what it means to restore that culture. How do we go about doing that practically? But I think in general, let's talk first about just what do we mean by when we talk about culture? And that sounds very highfalutin to some people and stuff, but what do we really mean when we talk about building a culture? What are we trying to do when we talk about a culture?
I'm a great fan of a couple of authors in the mid 20th century who were pointing the way towards this problem that now, which is that the very thing itself, culture, is shriveling. It's fading away. Authors I have in mind: Catholic authors, Father Romano Guardini, and the French philosopher Gabriel Marcel. They saw in the offing after World War II, and not that long after World War II either, that the true thing, culture, was being replaced by mass society, right? So people by the millions watching the same, listening to radio programs, watching the same television programs, reading news sources from only a couple of different venues, right? UN, Reuters, and AP, while losing the very human thing itself, culture. And I think that they were onto something. I think that they were right. Joseph Pieper talks in much the same way about the modern world as a world of culture or vanishing culture. If you go back to the word that gives rise to the word cultura in Latin, we're talking about tilling a field, you know, carefully tending to the soil, right? Because you want something to grow from it. You don't want to just use it, abuse it, and then move on to something else. It involves a lot of care. And this is intergenerational. I mean, you don't just say, all right, we're going to do this, and then we're going to move on. Culture takes into account the distance and looks forward to the future, right? If you don't have, I can put it this way, and I have this way many of my writings, right? I mean, if you are this strange people that the world has never seen before, or your children are not singing the songs that their grandfathers and grandmothers sang, you've got a problem. Okay. If they're not reciting by heart the poems, which were also songs that their grandparents recited, then something's very odd here. Okay. This is the outlier in human history. This has never really been the case before. Even before a people would have writing, songs and poems, which would be passed down from generation to generation. And almost all of that is gone now. The musical heritage is gone. The poetic heritage is gone. Most of the arts are gone. They've established little niches for themselves in the academy, which is poison, or in the art industry, like the art museum industry. But really, it's not a thing of the people, which it always had been. And there are basic cultural things that we are not getting done at all. Forgetting about arts and literature, we don't even manage to get the boys and girls together to enjoy each other's company and then to get married. We're not even doing that. I mean, we're failing at the fundamental human task of survival beyond care. That is to get children and to have those children thrive, because inheriting from you good habits of life, they're getting married young, they're having, don't even manage to do that. I would say that makes us unique in the history of man. A uniquely colossal and inhuman failure.
It is interesting because that touches on all aspects of society, really, because it touches on obviously the arts, it touches on schools, it touches on families, touches on communities, on parishes, all these different things. Because I think about like my own upbringing, and you know, I feel indicted a little bit, rightly so, because you know, I grew up, I went to public schools. I didn't live near where my grandparents lived. We'd go visit them once or twice a year and maybe hear a few stories. Didn't really know my upbringing that well. My whole family grew up in the South, and I grew up north of the Mason-Dixon line. Didn't really know, other than some jokes about, oh, we're on the wrong side now. But that's about it. But I don't really know my own culture. Because it's like I just went to public schools, learned the facts, and that was it. And it seems like, though, what you're really saying is that culture, the way it's passed on, it seems more like by osmosis than somebody standing up there and telling you this is your culture, right?
Yeah, the most fundamental thing about it is that it's lived. Hold on for a second as I pick up a book. Okay. Sometimes I, when people challenge me and they say, you know, you're really talking about something that's quite elite, right? I say, no, I'm not. I'm not. I'm talking about what is in ordinary human experience, okay? And then I pick up, for instance, one of my bound volumes of the Century magazine, from the late 19th century and early 20th century, popular magazine in the United States, all-purpose magazine, serialized novels by Mark Twain appear in it. If you want Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court and you want to read it before it gets to the library in a book form, you get the Century magazine, right? Huckleberry Finn, excerpts from Huckleberry Finn, printed in the Century magazine. So there's a magazine for everybody, right? I get random and I find articles on science, on religion, on poetry, on art, on music, on American history, on world history, talks with Napoleon, Paris, the giant Indians of Tierra del Fuego in South America, article on Oliver Cromwell, article on composer Meyerbeer, talks with Napoleon again. A short story and so forth. Things are in this. And I will bet that this magazine, which, the most popular magazine in the United States at the time, would be difficult for most college graduates to read now.
Wow.
Okay? You were a 14-year-old boy and you wanted to read the next excerpt of Huckleberry Finn. This is where you went. Okay, but college graduates would find it difficult going, not just because the vocabulary is taxing, but because there's a whole wealth of general knowledge that the authors just take for granted. I mean, they take for granted that you know a lot of things, and they don't take for granted that you've learned them in school. They take for granted that you've learned them just from living, from occasionally poking your nose into a book or a newspaper. So almost all of that is gone. And what's more poignant still, I find it also in these magazines, is their description of a common human life, right? That is filled with things that seem to come to us from a different universe, okay? But are deeply cultural things. And as you say, they're not things that you learn in school, right? They're part of the lived habits of the people. They bind the people together, such as we are not bound now. So, for instance, there's an article in here by the urban reformer Jacob Riis. He's wrote the book about how the other half lives, right? And it's about winter, midwinter in New York City in Manhattan. Part of it describes, the tough life that you have if you live in one of the tenements, and the danger, right? Because people have coal stoves or wood stoves. There's always danger of fire in the winter, and that's a terrible thing. But on the other hand, he described what these people did for fun when it snowed in New York. It's an amazing thing. I mean, all night long, kids and young people would be outdoors, sometimes with their elders too, sledding or tobogganing down one of the hills in Manhattan, or coasting on ice, and a slide of ice and on the road. And it really is all through the night, because he says there you'll see the strong youth of America well into the daylight hours. So they're on a good snowy night all night long and into the early morning. Okay. And the policeman, he said, would wink or look the other way. How is this even possible? Well, it's possible because everybody for granted there are certain things you do and certain things you don't do. And everybody also takes for granted that life is to be lived together, and not, with a little house over here and a little house over there. There's a great deal of social trust here, entirely missing now. I mean, imagine you could have your child taken away from you if it was sledding down a road in the middle of the daytime without supervision. These kids were out all night and into the next morning. We've got a lot of rebuilding to do.
What do you think was what do you think was the, what's the root cause? Because in listening to you, I feel like that some finger has to be pointed at just simply the development of technology, in the sense of, like, for example, highways and cars and the suburbs and the spreading out and the ability to communicate without being actually physically close together, communicate at least the basic information. Because I just use my own example. We moved away. My parents, I'd say, moved away before I was born, away from home, hundreds of miles away, because they could just drive, back if they wanted to. But really, that happened maybe twice a year. And then just, living out in the suburbs, the neighborhoods that most people live in, you don't really have that close a connection. Technology with, like, television and mass communications, you sit at home in front of the blue screen all day. I'm just kind of thinking of all these things as you're talking, that are those some of the root causes? And I mean, it makes it sound like Luddites, I know, but it just seems like those things didn't really help keep the culture.
No, they, in large part, they did not help. They presented certain opportunities, but they also presented certain dangers, right? So we had this, I've now come around to the opinion that it is a wonderful new art form, the film, the motion picture. For 30 years in the United States, it had a golden age, coinciding with the age of the self-imposed code, okay, from 1935 to about 1965. movies that are real works of art and wholesome works of art, not decadent or diseased great works of art. Like, for instance, The Godfather are great works of art of a very decadent kind, I think. But in any case, we had that. But people were not quite aware of how much of a threat it would end up being. Something peculiar that's cultural. I was talking to my wife about this the other day. Back when the black pitcher, Satchel Paige, very late in his career, joined the Cleveland Indians because he'd been in the Negro Leagues. They finally broke the color barrier with Jenkinson. So the Indians signed Satchel Paige and Larry Doby and a couple of other players that had been barred from Major League Baseball before. And Paige gets on the team. One of the first things asked by one of his teammates when he hears Satchel speak, when he hears his speaking voice, is, "Hey, Satch, can you sing?" And Satch said, "Well, of course I can sing. Would you like to sing? We're getting together a barbershop quartet." And Satch says, "Sure, I'd like that." They did. And this is not peculiar. This is the kind of thing that guys did. And these Cleveland Indians would, before ball games at home, go behind home plate when they had a little bit of time and serenade with their impromptu barbershop quartet songs. Okay.
That's can't see Barry Bonds doing that.
A completely different person. No, you can't see Barry Bonds. But you can't see anybody doing that now because nobody knows any songs. Thing. That was still, it was still the case. The amazing thing is not that there was a group of guys there singing, but that the ball players would take a little bit of time out before a game and do that. That was a little bit of a surprise, but I'm not a surprise at all, right? If you said, "Hey, there are four guys over there and they sing together," you'd say, "Well, yeah, so let's do that." Now that would be something, right? The church should have been more aware of the dangers, and this is where I take some the council fathers at Vatican II. I read the Vatican II documents and I see where they were somewhat aware of the unprecedented threats to human flourishing that the contemporary world posed. And yet the documents are pervaded with a kind of modern optimism.
Right.
And I don't think that optimism was at all justified. The circumspection was justified, and there was a lot of that in there.
Right.
You know, it's like right at the time when the 60s, when so many fundamental human things are either going to be lost or they've been riddled with termites and nobody's been noticing how weak they have become, and all at once they're going to collapse. And the technology has been, and we should have been more aware of it and should have been better prepared to meet its challenges, to avoid it when it needed to be avoided. We were sighted by it, and everybody was blindsided. But now I don't think there's any excuse. We've had a century of rapid technological change, and you know, it's the television has been around years. No more excuses on that score, and we should really know better, and we don't.
Right.
Schools stick computer screens in front of school children.
Yeah, I was on a school board of like a small Catholic school years ago, elementary school. And I was the computer programmer at the time. And I remember they were like saying, hey, let's get computer training to these kindergarten kids and first grade kids. And they looked at me like I would support them because I'm a computer programmer. I'm like, are you kidding me? And I was just, they wanted to like stick these screens in front of like kindergarten kids. This is a Catholic school, with pretty good Catholic school too. And they just didn't see it though. And this was 20 years ago. Even then, I think they should have, you know, seen it. But now it's like, do we really need want kids in front of screens more? And that's, they think that somehow that, because you still see it today.
They should hardly be in front of screens at all. When are they going to learn how to read a good book? Right? Or sing, or play a musical instrument, build a garage, or dig a well, or go fishing, or climb trees, or get up a ball, or anything human. What possible advantage does the screen to mere children? Right. The threats, the filthiest stuff imaginable is just a typewritten word in one click away.
It, when you read things from the 1960s, and including the Vatican II documents, I almost feel sorry for the optimism they had. That they had this great optimism that, and it was kind of weird because they're coming out of World War II, you'd think after all that evil being perpetrated, they would realize the human condition's not the greatest. But they had this optimism, and you can tell it is based upon this idea of technological advancement somehow brings about human advancement just automatically, that because we have better technology now, we're going to go to the moon soon, all these things, somehow that makes us as humans better. But like you said, today, I don't see how people can associate those two things together anymore.
No, I don't see how either. You know, the great technological advancement, I have to confess, has been the computer, the microprocessor and so on. Otherwise, all the great lofty dreams of technological improvement that were dreamed up in the 60s. None of them have come to pass, right? We don't all have our own airplanes. We are not setting up a colony on the moon or on Mars. I wonder whether the pace of technological advancement as regards physical objects, buildings and so forth, I wonder if that really is proceeding, or if it has not got up outside of the computer and computer-like things. Where has been the great technological in my lifetime, right? Since in the last 60 years, where has it been? And yet, you know, worrying about whether human beings would be subordinated to the tools they were using, those worries have been with us since the middle of the 19th century. And, you know, wise people have constantly been saying, listen, you need to take stock of this, okay? These things, we shouldn't just think that these things happen automatically, and whatever they do, they do. We should not consider human beings to be the tail that the technological dog is wagging. Right, we should be in control of technology for purposes, for human purposes. And if it no longer serves the most human things, then we should not use it. We should get rid of it. Why would you want a tool that makes your life less happy than it was before, or less human? And these things, the church had the wherewithal to understand what's going on. And, churchmen, too, are a product of their times. Now we are dealing with, I think, with church led by people who themselves are very thin culturally, right?
Right.
And they, you know, them, for instance, about bringing beauty back to the lives of ordinary Catholics. It's almost impossible. What can you talk about? We at Magdalen College, we try to introduce students or reintroduce them to works that should be part of any decently educated human being or Catholic's heritage, part of their heritage, right? These things should be a matter of course, right? It should be a matter of course that they're conversant with the great poetry in their mother tongue, that they're somewhat familiar with great works of art from the West, especially Christian works of art, that they're somewhat familiar with the nearly 2,000 years of Christian hymnody. But they're not. So we try to make up for that deficiency. That should be energetically trying to make up for that deficiency or to rebuild after the world has been reduced to sticks and rubble. But it's nearly impossible to talk to people because they'll immediately get nervous and they'll say, well, you're an elitist, which is to miss the point entirely. And they, partly they get nervous because nobody likes to be shown up. I mean, nobody likes to be told, you know, he had a lot, you know, there's all these perfectly ordinary human things that you don't know how to do because nobody knows how to do them because that's, you know. I have had to learn so many things in the artificial way, right? After the fact, which is part of my life when I was a kid growing up and weren't.
Now, let's talk practically a little bit how we can, obviously none of us are going to completely restore the culture of the world on our own, but what can an individual, like a family, what can we do practically, parents who are listening, or individuals, that to help start the process? I mean, obviously sending to a college like Magdalen College sounds like a great option, but even before that, in the home, what can, you know, because remember the parents aren't educated either, like you just said, none of us are. And so what can the parent, let's say a Catholic family do to, who probably goes to a parish that let's just say is culturally thin as well. And what can they do to try to restore culture, at least in their own families?
Okay, we can take this in a number of directions, right? So just scattershot off the top of my head. Go outside, okay? Things outside. Get dirty outside. Grow garden. Cut trees down. Climb trees. Build a hut. Do things outdoors, okay? Get food outdoors. Live a human life outdoors. Do it with as many people as possible, right? Get together. Let the kids go outdoors. Throw them outdoors. Stay. Tell them you have to come back in until supper time. Get lost. Go do something, okay? Read good books. They don't have to be the highest classics. Get John Senior's list of the 1,000 good books. And he said good books, not great books. Some of them are great books, but he put them on the list because they're good for the soul. And they should be part of people's heritage, right? Start reading good books. You don't know how to play a musical instrument. Learn how to play one. You don't know how to sing. Learn to sing. Sing together. Get together group who like to sing, right? Do things. Get away from whatever is mass, much as you can, all right? In the parish, hey, you know what? It would be nice if yims. And if you sang the authentic texts of the hymns instead of editorially mutilated, it's usually embarrassingly and stupidly so. Versions of the hymns that are in Gather and Worship For and Glory and Praise and Hymns Are Us, call them generally Hymns Are Us. Even the traditional hymns, what few managed to survive in, have been mangled, all right? They're sometimes they're almost unrecognizable, but they've been mangled. you know, sing the real stuff. Get rid of the slop and bring back real hymns. And those include folk hymns, because what has been passed along as folk hymns in Catholic churches in English speaking countries in my lifetime, folk music, that's show tune music for off Broadway musical or something. There's not folk music. You want folk? Go to the old hymnals. Old hymnals are full of folk music. Okay. They're full of Bach and Mendelssohn and Brahms themselves are full of folk music, and they're also full of music that's directly from the folk without Bach and Mendelssohn and Brahms. Start to do that. There's so much. I suppose I was hesitant about saying get up together reading groups in your parishes, because there are more fundamental uneven than that. Here's one thing that is desperately needed in every single parish in this country, every single one. The boys and the girls do not enjoy each other's company anymore. And there's for that, because what they have seen by the time they're 13 or 14 years old has scorched their soul. All right. And they are taught to be wary of one another, to think of one another as liars, manipulators, predators. This is utterly unhealthy. Okay. They don't think when they grow up, they'll go out on dates. They're not going to do that. Nobody does that. That's not happening. Okay. Every single person needs to see to it that the young people, the boys and the girls, have wholesome ways of enjoying each company, one sex with the other sex. Okay. Specifically as boys and specifically as girls, not just indiscriminate teenagers, but as boys and girls. Where are the dances? Okay. Let's suppose you're a teenager in the year 1960, before everything falls off the edge of a cliff, right? You're a 17-year-old boy. There's a 17-year-old girl, just moved into town, and she's very pretty, and you would like with her, okay? What can you ask her to do? You can ask her to do all kinds of things. First of all, it's no big deal for you to ask her, because everybody does that. Everybody expects it. Everybody does it. Okay. It's just a common expected thing. So you do. So what do you, where do you go? Well, you could go play miniature golf or bowling. You could go see a show and it won't be foul, right? You can go see a movie, or you can go to a dance. You can listen to a concert. There are all kinds of things in all kinds of places. Almost all of that is gone, right? I mean, a little town, as late as the mid 70s, my little podunk town in coal country of Pennsylvania would still have dances, at least one every week during in the spring, the early autumn. And things had already gone south by then, right? But they were things that were a lot healthier 15 years, 20 years before. Where are they all, right? Nobody knows that. And that's just one single feature of this tremendous fact, which nobody in any capacity that I've seen in our church seems to have any awareness of, that there is absolutely nothing healthy for an ordinary teenage boy and teenage girl to do with one another. And so they don't. And this means that if they obey the moral law, they are lonely. Okay. And I don't even want to talk about that, because the things that are common now are almost unspeakable. Right. What have the churches done? What have the church done to provide wholesome ways of getting the young people comfortable with one another as the sexes and getting them married? We've done almost nothing. Right? I'm talking about fun things. Yeah. I'm not talking about marriage preparation.
Yeah.
Which is kind of like orthodontics. I'm talking about fun.
And I It sounds, though, to me like in today's culture, at least today's society, one of the probably the best ways to do that is through homeschooling groups, because it just, because like, you know, we homeschool, and at one point when we homeschooled, we lived in an area where there was almost no other homeschoolers, and it was tough. I mean, it was tough for the kids because, like you said, there was just no opportunities for activities. But at the same time, we didn't feel comfortable putting them in a public school where there were plenty of activities and they were all awful. And so it's like, okay, well, we had to choose between those two bad options. And fortunately, we live now where there's more opportunities. But I think that seems to be one path forward, is for homeschooling communities to hold these dances, hold various some ways for people to get together. I mean, unfortunately, you can't just send them out to the movies because most of the movies are trash or whatever.
No, not now. Not now. Well, parishes, right? They should be key players in this. They really. Think about what we used to have. There used to be the CYO, right? Catholic Youth Organization. And there was CYO basketball. That was coast to coast, right? It's everywhere. The first basketball court in my little coal mining town was not built by the public school. It was built by the parish. Father Comerford, 100 years ago, with family money, built a three-story parish hall. Okay. He was thinking, right? I need the gainers, something wholesome and interesting and fun to do that doesn't involve, okay, thirsty coal miners after 10 hours of work down underneath are, prone to get drunk. So he built a three-story parish hall. There was a billiards room, right? There was a reading room, the small library. There were meeting rooms, 4 hour, okay? And on the third floor, a basketball court and a theater stage with curtain and lights, so that up there you could put on plays or concerts, or you have a dance, or you could play basketball, okay? And the public high school across the street had the free use of that basketball court for their students, because they didn't have one. Obviously, parishes, I suppose, can't afford to do that now. And Father Comer, with his own money, his family money. But the idea is, right, let's get the people together doing ordinary things that people do, get them doing them in a wholesome way, right? Nothing in the parish hall had specifically a religious nature. A pool, but it's a brilliant conception. Right. Concerts and dances and ice cream socials and ways for the boys and the girls about each other, as boys, as girls, and get people married, to have young people have fun, having fun. And if we're not doing that, the reading Crime and Punishment, it's not quite, you know, I'm not, hey, let's all read Dostoevsky. I love Dostoevsky. He's the greatest novelist ever. Or Charles Dickens, and yet, you know, no, I don't want everybody reading Crime and Punishment or the Brothers Karamazov, or Spacement. Not before they've had ice cream socials and dances and concerts and, all the human things which are not in place.
I'm sure you're probably familiar with Rod Dreher's book, The Benedict Option. And I think there's some overlap here. I'm just kind of wondering your thoughts on that, because I think his point's a little bit more political, I know, but it's the idea that we've lost the culture wars. just we need to admit that fact, and then we rebuild the culture through these small communities. Is what you're saying similar to that, or is there differences between kind of that idea of seeing us losing the culture wars and building up a community through like a St. Benedict type way of these monastic communities? Not that we would be the monastic communities, but you know what I mean? Something like that, that helps build the culture.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's a lot of overlap. He wrote his book at the same time that I wrote Out of the Ashes, Rebuilding American Culture, and Archbishop Chaput wrote a book. There's a lot of overlap, and I've talked to Rod about these things. We had a conference about just this subject at our Touchstone magazine conference a few years ago. He understands that we're not talking about separatism, right? Understands too that these are things that have to be done in a community, okay? About a family here, a family there, or even a little tiny group of families here and a little tiny group there. We're talking about something bigger than that. I sometimes call them outposts of sanity, okay? We can call them outposts of fun, too. Eventually, what you want is that people from the world, right? A world that really doesn't even pretend anymore to have anything great to recommend it, okay? A world where nobody even pretends that everybody has a lot of ordinary human fun. Even Disney is grim and sour and bitter. You know, they'll say, hey, you know, we're missing something human here. I think it needs to be done in communities. And this is why the parish is so important. The parish is sort of a ready-made, okay? It's got the land, it's got a building, it's got a reason for people coming together regularly, getting to know each other. It's a lot of fun little things are there that can be worked up, right? The one thing that I'll say, and I think Rod would agree with this, is that it's not so much that we've lost the culture as that we have lost, but there is no culture against which we're fighting. There's a monstrosity there that goes sometimes by the name of a culture, but it isn't real culture. It is a monster, but it doesn't make anybody happy. It does make a lot of people rich. It does make some certain people, but it doesn't make anybody happy. And in that regard, we're not fighting against some, we're fighting against a great big nothing, a great big vacuity and emptiness, rubble, okay? And so presents to us an unprecedented opportunity. Back in the old days, when you went to evangelize people, they had a pagan culture, and you had to strive with that. Also presented you things to work with, because every culture would possess some measure of truth and beauty. Now, the thing over there had really nothing to offer, because it is nothing. It's a great, big, monstrous nothing.
Which gives us a bit of an advantage in that we can...
Harder.
Yeah, I was just going to say, it gives us a bit of an advantage. I was going to say, there's nothing to fight against, in the sense that there's nothing attractive about what's going on right now. So if we actually present something attractive, which is probably what's so frustrating, I think, about how the church presents herself today, it presents herself in the least attractive way possible, almost. And so, but if we really present ourselves in the most attractive way, it is something that people will be attracted to, because, I mean, our competition is, like you said, this monstrous nothing.
Yeah, let me give you an example. So at our school, Magdalen College, right, all of the students participate in the choir. All of them are always up there singing. All students participate to a large degree, are really central to the whole thing. Okay, so week or so before Christmas, about 40 or 50 of the students came down in front of my house here in town, and sang for us Advent and Christmas, Advent hymns and Christmas carols. Okay, and fascinating thing happened. We've got new neighbors on one side of us here. I haven't really met them yet. Strange, okay? Because in a normal human culture, you'd have met them like the next day. Right. But we're not normal. I think they're on the political left. At least their bumper stickers suggest it. And the people across the street don't seem to have any particular religion at all. There's these kids, they're singing, and they're singing in harmony, right? Boys and girls, young men and women singing in four-part harmony, sometimes singing polyphonically. And it is immensely attractive. People are attracted to it before they even think, oh, gee, what's the ideology here? They don't even think that. They're attracted to it because it's normal, it's human. And people stopped. If they were walking past, they stopped, or they came out door because they heard it, and they stood out in the cold and they listened to it. They didn't know any of the kids. They listened to it. It's like, holy cow. How about that? I only saw that in once.
I think that's a perfect example.
Multiply
of
that by 100.
Right. And if our parishes are presenting beauty, and obviously our homes and things like that, those things are attractive to people. And like you said, it's not a matter of thinking first of all, what's the ideology behind it? They're like, this is just beautiful. I'm attracted to it. I think it's neat. I mean, it's as simple as that.
Yeah, and fun. If your parish is big enough, and it, of course, I wouldn't have to add that qualifier because there were so many kids. That it wouldn't matter if you had a small parish. There should be so many kids, but together a couple of baseball teams and play each other every week or so during the summer. Pick up baseball games. And don't be embarrassed to say, you know what, this is for the boys. Okay. Don't be embarrassed to say that. There's no need to be embarrassed. Some things you can get together. Some things only. And then some things bring them together. And as the more public these things be better, then people look at them and they say, I don't know what the they're drinking over there at that table, but I want to serve me some of what they're drinking. Okay. And somebody will say, oh, you don't want to be around with those Catholics. They believe this, they believe that. Person might ultimately say, listen, I don't even care what they believe right now. Right now, I don't know what they believe. I don't care what they believe, but I see this. They're having fun. they're doing something interesting. Holy cow, it looks like those young people. I haven't seen a boy and a girl holding hands in 15 years. And look, there it is over there. I don't know what they're drinking. Give me some of it.
Right.
Okay.
I think,
and
yeah, I was going to say,
we say, you know, we've got some special wine.
I think, though, like what I see in a lot of parishes, I see this, there's a parish nearby like this that's pretty large. It has lots of activities, but it doesn't seem to be doing at all what you're saying. What I mean by that is the people I know it's not my parish, but I have some friends who go there. They're just overscheduled with lots of different, you know, they have their soccer meets, and they have like a soccer, they actually have a gymnasium, they actually have a soccer field and things like that. But it just seems like what happens is the families are just so busy. They're just going from this to that to that. And they're just almost like running around like chickens with their head cut off to do all these things. And it's a lot of it's through the parish. Yeah. So obviously that's good, but that doesn't seem to be what you're saying. So what's the difference between overscheduling and just doing all these and having lots of activities and kind of the life of the parish that you're talking about?
You know, the best thing about a lot of this is it doesn't need to involve signing up. Once these things are well established, they go on and you show up if you feel like it, right? You just show up. Back in the old days, when there were lots of kids and you had a little league in town, people would just show up to watch the game. They didn't even have to have a kid there. They say, well, there's a game over there. I'm going to take a peek and just sit down and what's going on. If it's a sort of regular on a Sunday afternoon in the summer, that you have a ball game in the field, well, that's, you know, again, that this is not something that necessarily you have to commit to. We do too much of that, okay? Much of what I'm about needs to be established and tended at first, but when it's healthy, has a life of its own, right? And you would just say to yourself, hey, you know, I don't have anything to do. Let's go on over to hear the music at the church this afternoon. Right? Because it's there. There's this girl I like. I'd like to ask her to do something fun with me. What can I do? Well, you know, there's the church is having ice cream. Oh, okay. Yeah, sure. I'll do that. Right. It's tough to get them started, but when they're healthy, they go on and it's not official in any way. You know, it's not a duty.
Right.
It's there like a bowling alley. Right. So many of these things are gone.
Yeah. Yeah, that's for sure.
Where's the bowling alley?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, yeah, I think that's the idea of it's not these scheduled activities that we're breaking up our days with, but just like, okay, there's things to do. And you can choose to do them or choose not to do them. Yeah.
We need to be more deliberate about this at first, but that the kind of deliberation is in large part artificial. Right. It's necessary, but once things are established in a healthy, don't need that anymore.
It becomes more natural. I think we're going to wrap it up here pretty soon, but I just wanted to, one more question I just wanted to ask was, if you're a Catholic family, you go to your parish and you want to implement some of this stuff at your parish, this is the tough question. How do you go about doing it? How do you approach the pastor to say, you know, obviously he doesn't want more work to do. How do you approach a parish to say, hey, let's do this or that? What's kind of the best way, how to get started moving in this direction?
You got me. I'm no great organizer and I could never organize anything. I can hardly organize my day. I suppose you might go to say, Father, young people don't have anything healthy to do. We have a fail here. How about a dance? Well, nobody knows how to dance. Well, let's get together somebody who knows about dancing, old fashioned styles of dance, and you know, maybe we can have some fun, not just dancing, but learning how to dance. What about it, Father? And, you know, once he decides that the insurance company will allow it, that there's another problem.
Yeah, right.
Then, you know, go for it. Go for it.
That's a great way to start. I mean, just even learning how to dance and things like that.
I know how to dance. I don't.
Yeah, I definitely don't. My kids have done some, they had a dance, some dance lesson classes at like Franciscan University of Steubenville, I know, and they did some dances there, which was, you know, that was nice. And they've learned some, I think those are good, but I think even earlier than college age would be nice at the high school age and things like that.
Oh gosh, you should be learning that stuff when you're 7 or 8 years old.
Yeah, that's true. Nobody does those.
So. Really?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, yeah, I think I mean, it should be. That's another one of the things that happens naturally in a healthy culture. Nobody has to say, "Oh, let's plan on this." It just happens,
right?
You know, you didn't take square dance classes in Tennessee. You just grew up learning.
Yeah, you just everybody did it.
Yeah.
Well, let's, before we go, I want to ask you to let us know how we can find out about your books. Is there a particular book that came out recently you want to promote, or just how we can find out and get, obviously go to Crisis Magazine. I just want to make a note real quick. One of the most popular pages on the Crisis Magazine website is the author page, your author page on there. Like, we get more hits on that page than almost anything
else.
It's amazing. Yeah, it's amazing. I guess when they search on you, that must be where they go. So. But yeah, so how can people find out?
Oh gosh, I didn't know that. Yeah. I'd like people to check out Magdalen College of the Liberal Arts, both for sending your young people here. A wonderful place, and it's quite healthy in all the ways that I've been describing, right? Or to, if you don't have young people who are of college age, to really strongly consider donating to us instead of to your alma mater or your mater ferox. I mean, why shawnee to such places as usually gets the money, right? We could use the support, and we use the your prayer and students. And as for my books, the book that you meant is out and available. A running commentary on the first 18 verses of the gun, which Catholics used to hear at the end of every Mass, the so-called last gospel. But for a rebuilding culture, this is one salvo of mine in that it's the book of it's a single poem, which is a book of poems, 100 poems called A Hundredfold. And if you're afraid of poetry, don't worry. I write in traditional meters, and there are 40 pages of an introduction to explain how to read a poem. Again, the sort of thing that you didn't have to do in the old days, just as you didn't have to teach young people how to dance because they picked it up when they were growing up. But you do have to teach people how to do that now. And you do have to teach people what a poem is now, and so I do this. And there are... these are all centered upon the life of Christ, okay? I really have meant it as, you know, getting it out there saying, hey, fellow Christian Catholics, we need to take back this portion of culture, too, because it, too, has been reduced to rubble. It's been abandoned. Well, let's take it back. Poetry, I mean, okay? Let's take it back. The universal human art. No culture is without it except for us.
I'll make sure I link to Magdalen College and Out of the Ashes and The Hundredfold. I know my wife has read The Hundredfold. We have that here somewhere, but I haven't. So now I'm encouraged to, because I admit I'm not a poetry guy. So now I'm encouraged to actually pick it up, especially the part where you said it explains how to read poetry. That's the part I need.
Oh, yeah, I teach you what's going on. And to whet your appetite even a little bit more, 12 of the poems are dramatic monologues spoken by some character in the time of Christ or shortly after. Okay. So, for instance, what would St. Peter say to himself on that fateful night when he denied Christ? After the cock crowed and he wept bitterly, what's Peter thinking? Well, that's one of the one of the monologues. Or that blind man Bartimaeus, after he's been given his sight, what would he say? Imagine that boy who had the couple of fishes when Jesus multiplied the loaves and fishes. Now he's a grandfather and he's telling his grandsons about what happened. What would he say? Okay.
That sounds intriguing.
What does that man say? Or Mary, Joseph has passed away. Jesus has not begun yet. It's early in the morning. He's asleep. And she's looking at him. And she's still thinking, a sword shall pierce her heart. She's thinking about him. And she worries. What does she say to herself?
Sounds very good. Sounds excellent. I can't wait to pick it up now.
Okay.
Well,
you'll have to tell me what you think.
Yes, I will. I'm sure my wife loved it, so I'll have to figure out, I'll have to pick it up now. So very good. Well, we're going to end here, and I appreciate the time and hopefully some practical tips for people. And I think it's a very important, it's kind of the underlying, we talk about a crisis, all the different issues going on, and we try to give minor things, but this is like the current underneath it that's kind of pushing everything. And so this is how we kind of dig a little deeper into the current and try to maybe change the course of the current more rather than just the things on that are floating on the top, which is what we normally deal with. So, okay. Well, great. Thank you very much. And until next time, everybody, God love you.